Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, I'm very excited about this show. I like all my shows, and this one is very interesting. And our guest is James Corbett. James Corbett has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent, critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Since then, he has written, recorded, and edited thousands of hours of audio and video media for the website, including a podcast and several regular online video series. He produces video reports for GRTV and BoilingFrogsPost.com. He is also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, the weekly newsletter created by the late Bob Chapman. And today we will be talking about his excellent documentary, How Big Oil Conquered the World. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with James Corbett. James Corbett, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on. I've been a follower of your work for a long time and really appreciate your website, your Corbett Report. So tell my listeners a little bit about yourself and about the Corbett Report.
All right. Well, I'm a Canadian by birth, and I lived and grew up in Canada all of my life until I hit the ripe old age of 22, and I decided to take a trip over to Ireland for a year to study Anglo-Irish literature at Trinity mm-hmm. College in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And after that, I was thinking about what to do with my life, which at that time was how to kill another year and maybe make a bit of money so I can start paying off these college tuition.
Right.
And so the inevitable answer to that for me as an English major was teach English. And so I decided to come out to Japan and do that. And so in 2004, I came to Japan. And I've lived here for 12 years now. About 2006, I started down the rabbit trail, as they say, encountering mm-hmm. all sorts of information online that I'd never even suspected in my life before, let alone knew anything about. And once that started to happen, I realized that contrary to any tendency that I'd ever had in my entire life, I needed to share this information. So I decided to start a website. So in 2007, I started the Corbett Report. It is basically, it was meant originally simply to be a podcast, but it's evolved into podcasts and videos and interviews and articles. Basically one-stop media machine right. on all sorts of issues that I'm interested in, from history and science and politics and basically anything else that tickles my fancy.
Well, we were talking a little bit before we started recording, and I was telling you I was in Japan 5 years ago, and I worked a lot with a group of Americans who were doing the same thing, mostly teaching English, and they had formed some kind of a labor coalition there, and I worked with them. So I don't know.
You were mentioning the incredible work ethic yeah. of the people here in Japan, and yeah. I can attest to that. And I guess I still am, but I certainly was a part of it when I was teaching English full time and working on my website pretty much full time. So there were a lot of sleepless nights or nights where I'd stay up till 3 or 4 in the morning and then get up at 6:30 to go and teach. And right. that's how the website was built. And luckily, 5 years ago, I took the plunge and did this full time. And now I'm supported by subscribers and donators and people who buy DVDs. And amazingly enough, that is possible. So I am now a professional podcaster, which is a profession I didn't even know that didn't even exist when I was in high school preparing for my path down the career.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, that's basically what I do, too, and the activism. And, you know, if you live simply and and I are committed to a cause, I think it makes it, for me at least, much easier to devote my time to this.
I agree completely. And I think people can, I do put faith in people that they can see through just a phony shtick versus people who are truly dedicated to something, to a message, to an idea. And if that idea resonates with other people, I think they will be there to support it. Because it really is just a question of the old media paradigm where people were happy to shell out whatever, $50 a year for a subscription to Time Magazine or something, versus now this paradigm where you can directly support people that you think are making a positive contribution that aren't part of that corporate media nexus. And I, to me, it's a pretty simple calculation. And I think more and more of the population is catching on to that.
Right. And you said in 2006, you went down the rabbit hole. What kind of led you there?
I wish I had an idea of what specifically, what the penny was that dropped. It was a number of different things. Basically, it was me moving into an apartment here in Japan that came with an internet connection. And it was the first time for years that I'd had an internet connection at home. I had previously been going to internet cafes to do emailing and that sort of thing. But now I had, I had an internet connection in my home. And suddenly I encountered Google Video and YouTube and these other, you know, video sharing platforms that I hadn't had before. And as is my wont, I was always politically interested. And so I started looking at political videos online. And suddenly I was encountering in the related video section of YouTube and places like that, I was encountering these videos, these conspiracy documentaries talking about things about 9/11 and other things that I would have dismissed out of hand. Until I started to take a look at some of them and started to find some things that, well, I don't know if I can disprove that. Let me go search for some of that information. And through that process, I started to encounter all sorts of different information about Operation Northwoods and government false flag terrorism. And it was actually a documentary about the banking system called The Money Masters, which was one of the really eye-opening things for me that started to really make sense of everything that I'd been taught my entire life. When you start to encounter the idea of what is money and who creates money and how is it created, why is the system engineered that way? Once I started down that particular rabbit hole, I think there was no escaping.
No coming back. So what do you make of the political circus here over in the United States? What's going on?
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. I wish I could say that in a positive way.
Right.
I think I have not been more pessimistic about the political situation in a long time. And this is coming from someone who thoroughly, thoroughly detested the Bush regime and everything it stood for. And then the Obama Hope and Change sellout that I saw coming from miles away, but saw a lot of good people who got suckered into it.
Right.
And I see nothing really hopeful on the horizon for this political selection period. I see that people are responding to the disenfranchisement that they feel both economically and politically and socially. There is that mood in the air, and that's why a Sanders and a Trump can wage these kinds of insurgencies on the establishment of their parties. To a certain extent, that's a positive phenomenon, but unfortunately, it is also really, I think, rending open the sort of blistering sore and scabs from the various internal culture wars in the United States that I think are starting to bubble to the surface. And that's just part of the divide and conquer strategy that has been played on the American public and, of course, all subjugated populations throughout most of history. And unfortunately, it's working its wonders once again, turning neighbor against neighbor because they're the wrong race or color or sex or sexual orientation or whatever it is, whatever difference that they can play on. And I see that coming to the fore now. And it's difficult to see how that genie can be put back in the bottle once it's unleashed. So I think we're going down this particular trail, and I don't know if it's going to end in a happy place for the United States.
Well, you know, it's an empire and all empires collapse. And I don't even know if we should be trying to save it.
Yes,
you know, and I think a lot of people's energies is like, how can we prevent or slow down, not prevent, but stall the collapse of the U.S. Right. empire when it would be way better for the world if it collapsed.
Yeah. My calculation at this point almost is, well, what candidate getting into power would have the best effect in completely, utterly dismaying everyone and really making everyone realize that the empire is collapsing? And to that extent, I don't know if a Clinton or a Trump presidency would be better in that regard. Maybe either way would fit the bill.
I'm a little bit harder on the Democrats because I was a Democrat, but, you know, I agree with your analysis. I think more that the Trump success shows more of the right are more disaffected with the system because Sanders is not a political outsider. You know, and he's been even though he's so-called independent, he's been caucusing with the Democrats and supporting Democrats for his whole political career.
Yeah, I agree.
So anyway,
It's kind of similar to the Ron Paul phenomenon when you think about
exactly. it. Exactly. I say that all the time. Yeah. But so the reason I reached out to you, and I'm glad I finally did, finally get you on the soapbox. But I just recently watched a documentary. I don't think it's brand new, but it's newish. It's called How Big Oil Conquered the World. And you made this documentary. To me, I was a history major in college, a U.S. history, and I actually concentrated in California history. So, you know, I'm really super familiar with how Standard Oil and Firestone and GM killed a public transportation system in Los Angeles. I mean, I'm born and raised in Los Angeles. My mom lived there since she was four, and she used to tell me tales of the you know, Los Angeles trolley cars that you can go anywhere in them. And I would look at her like she was telling me some kind of science fiction story. And so I'm very familiar with that part about how Big Oil killed public transportation in not just Los Angeles, but, you know, a lot of cities around the country. But your documentary, How Big Oil Conquered the World, has so much wonderful information in it. Some things that I didn't know. And that, you know, it was very comprehensive, but also very, you know, compacted in a short time, which I appreciated. So, I don't know where I want to start with this, because the one thing I did not know was about Devil Bill and snake oil. So maybe that's where we should start.
Yes, that is surprising, especially I because I think everyone has heard the Rockefeller family story and everyone knows something about John D. and the rise of Standard Oil.
I know about him for sure, but I think that's where my knowledge
very few
started.
Very few people have heard about his father. And that's funny because that is not, I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's not disavowed by the family. It's an acknowledged part of the family history that John D. Rockefeller's father was a lout, a philanderer, a rapist, a bigamist, changed his name, was a traveling snake oil salesman trying to scam people out of their money in city after city, got ran out of town. I mean, almost like a cartoon character in some ways. And yes, this is not very well known. But one thing that is a particularly interesting part of John D.'s upbringing, which is often cited even again in the mainstream Rockefeller biographies and documentaries, is that his father, Devil Bill, William Rockefeller, tried actually actively to scam his children and his grandchildren, to try to make them sharp, as he was quoted as saying. And this was the environment in which John D. was raised. Now, the official biographies will tell you, yes, okay, his father was this horrible person and basically drifted and eventually abandoned the family when he got accused of rape and basically went off to start a bigamist marriage. And so he didn't have a lot of involvement in John D.'s life from that point. And he was brought up by his mother, who was a very devout Baptist. And so John D. became a devout Baptist. That's the official line anyway. Uh-huh. But that's somewhat belied by the fact that even John D.'s first foray into business, in 1860-ish, he got $1,000 loan from his father, from Devil Bill, in order to start out into business. And from that point, he decided to get into oil refining and from there, the rest is history, as they say. But of course, that interest came with that loan came with interest, of course, at the going rate, whatever that rate was at that time. So I think there's more to that story than the official biographies let on. But at any rate, that is literally the origin of the Rockefeller Empire, is a literal snake oil salesman. It's not even figurative in this case.
Right, and snake oil's oil. And
yes,
so
exactly.
Right, and the thing that really interested me is this entire documentary. I really congratulate you on the documentation, and there's like no speculation. I can't stand documentaries that have speculation in them without backup. And so there would be nothing in this documentary that people can say, oh, you know, conspiracy theory, blah, blah, blah. But whenever I hear Rothschild, it always makes me a little nervous about things, because people, you know, they put so much, they give so much power, deservedly or not deservedly, I don't know. But my sister has cancer. She has stage 4 breast cancer. And so we watched that documentary about cancer and the Rothschilds and how, you know, the big pharmaceuticals came from that. And you did talk about that. And I don't have any problem with how you used the Rothschilds in this documentary at all. It was just very scholarly, and not, you didn't do any polemic, you know,
right.
You didn't
yeah.
like go, you didn't
no,
like
I understand,
go crazy with
I
it.
I understand the concern, because there is, as you say, with a lot of these documentaries, there's a lot of speculation and things that you have to basically take the narrator's word for.
Right.
And I obviously try to avoid that as much as possible in my work. And that's why I have the hyperlink transcript of this documentary and most of my major works online, so people can go and look at the sources themselves. But you're right, certainly with the Rothschild family, there's a lot of people blaming them for basically everything that's ever happened in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to separate a lot of that fantasy out from the facts that we can actually document. As an example, there's a lot of people that will say that J.P. Morgan was nothing other than a Rothschild front in the United States. And while his father did have documentable connections to the Rothschilds in Europe, there is no basis from what I can see for the claim that, for example, when J.P. Morgan died, they found that he only had 1/3 of his wealth himself, and the rest was held, you know, as front for the Rothschilds. Those kinds of claims are made, and I can't find documentation for those types of things. But I can find documentation for the claims that are in this documentary anyway. For example, obviously the Rothschilds did have a founding point part in what became Royal Dutch Shell.
Right.
From the trading concerns that were operating in the late part of the 19th century that ultimately merged in the beginning part of the 20th century, the Royal Dutch Petroleum and then Shell, which was a trading corporation which specialized in imports and exports, and was specifically contracted by the French Rothschild family, which was in charge of a particularly important oil deposit in the Caspian Sea region at that time, which had just been opened up by the Russian imperial family at that point to private development. So the Rothschilds were one of the key families involved in that, and they hired this Shell basically as their way of transporting that oil out. And that became part of the foundation of the Royal Dutch Shell dynasty. So basically this documentary is trying to look at those founding families and founding members that were there at the ground floor of what became the oil industry. Because I think one of the things that this documentary gestures towards, and which the follow-up that I'm currently working on will hopefully elaborate in much greater detail, is that the oil industry, yes, is now what we understand it to be, but it was about so much more than just oil, just petroleum. Petroleum is extremely important in the sense that it's a commodity that is the backbone of the energy infrastructure that we've based our entire civilization on at this point.
Right.
And it's easily monopolizable. And those two factors coming together was manna from heaven for those who want to form a system of really totalizing control over so many aspects of life, because all they had to do was corner the market for the petroleum and everything else fall into line. And that appealed to the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and people like that who have been involved in monopolizing these types of resources and benefiting from them in ways that most people don't even expect, as I hope the documentary started to show.
Well, and besides the Rockefellers and Rothschilds, you know, Standard Oil, obviously, Royal Dutch Shell, obviously. Talk about British Petroleum.
BP came from the ashes of the Anglo-Persian holdings, which basically there was an oil concession that was given in by the King of Persia at that time in the early 19th century. The early 20th century, that was developed by a British engineer, a British socialite, and they managed to discover just as they were about to give up on their concession, they managed to discover a huge, huge amount of oil in Iran that basically started the British petroleum industry off, really, in a significant way. And so it was merged more or less with the British government in the war years, and then afterwards with the British government taking a controlling interest in it. And so that became British Petroleum, the BP that we know today, which of course is, again, one of the largest oil companies on the planet. And it has played an incredibly important role in a lot of different operations of the oligarchy, as I meant them.
Right.
But I think it shows quite clearly the combination of governmental and private interests in the monopolization of these resources, and how vital it was, really, for the World War I and World War II, really, for the British government to have an oil company that they could basically play around with. That became an extremely important part, not only in the unfolding of those wars and how those wars were fought, but even in the setup to those wars, as I hope I showed with World War I, and the fact that World War I was predicated at least partly, a significant part of that was the growing rivalry between Britain and Germany. And part of the thing that really set the war, that set those two powers into a war footing, was Berlin's attempt to create that Berlin-Baghdad railway that would help them to ship their oil concessions right out of Iraq straight up to Berlin, bypassing any sea transport using a railway, which of course was anathema to the British naval power. So that was one of the things that really started the tensions into high gear in the early 20th century that led to World War I.
And the World War II, at least in the Pacific, had a lot to do with oil also.
It certainly did, not only for fighting for those resources. I mean, obviously, the fact that Japan had been more or less cut off from Western oil supplies, which more or less was intended through the memos that we now have to put Japan into a situation where they would strike first. So Pearl Harbor, in right. some ways, was part of a deliberate policy to try to get the Japanese to make that type of desperate action, which doesn't make any strategic or military sense. It only makes sense if you were a cornered power who was going to try to strike out. So that's the sense in which that started the Western, the Pacific theater in World War II. But also, I mean, let's not forget that Germany was a petroleum-poor country in a lot of ways and didn't have a lot of access to petroleum. So it would have been impossible for the German war machine to wage the war that it did and to operate the way it did without the active cooperation of, well, the Standard Oil, or at least the sort of leftovers of the Standard Oil Empire, which helped Germany to come up with a process for converting its coal into usable oil for its war machine. And that was part of the active cooperation that existed on many, many different levels between corporate America and the Nazi German war machine.
Well, let's go back to this Rockefeller guy for a second. I feel like I'm jumping all over the place. I did post your documentary in my last two newsletters, and I've gotten a lot of people tell me thank you for it. They really have appreciated it, and they really liked it. But how, like, serendipitous was it that, you know, Rockefeller starts getting into, you know, the heating oil business, and then all of a sudden it's needed to, you know, run cars?
Right. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about this the other day.
Yeah. I mean, there are a series of historical incidents here that, in one way, I guess, if you're thinking from the Rockefeller perspective, of the right person at the right place at the right time to create this empire, or from humanity's perspective, the wrong person, the wrong place in the wrong time, I guess. But yes, there are certain historical phenomenon here that are obviously just beyond the control of anyone that created this empire. But I think to a certain extent, it is what you make of it. And if you are a suitably cutthroat business person who wants to create and corner and a monopoly of an important resource like this, then there are ways to do that. And I think, well, one of the things that I attempted to display in this documentary is that it was by no means certain, even at the end of the 20th century, going into the early 20th century, it was by no means certain that petroleum powered cars were going to be the transportation of the future.
Right.
Electric cars had existed since the, electric engines had existed since the early part of the 19th century, and working electric vehicles had been in operation since, I believe, the 1870s, and you had the British taxis that were running on electricity in the 1890s. Not only electricity, but of course alcohol as a potential fuel was also widely used and widely talked about and widely promoted by even people like Henry Ford, who even into the 1920s was still arguing that that cars should be that it would be a great boon for the American farmer to if alcohol fuels were further developed, because, well, anything growing on the side of the road could be a potential fuel, which of course, again, is anathema to people who want to monopolize a resource if you can have a readily available resource like that. So it had to be a key part of the business empire that Rockefeller was building to make sure that those alternatives would not thrive, would not exist, would not be viable. And one of the things that worked in his favor was just serendipity, I guess. The discovery of the spindle top in Texas in the early part of the 1900s, which definitively tipped the balance in favor of gas in terms of pricing. Once you had spindle top online pumping out all of that, I think it was 1 million barrels a day, something along those lines, all of that oil, it greatly reduced prices, so that it was very obviously that within a few years of that going online, gas prices were going to be significantly below alcohol fuel prices. And that, unfortunately, is generally the decision people make on their purchases. If I can get it cheaper, I'm going to use gas. So that did help. And that was just kind of a serendipitous thing. But there were other strategic things that were employed by the Standard Oil monopoly to ensure their monopoly, including the taking out of alcohol fuel as a potential rival. And how could that possibly be done? How could you do that? Well, there had been a pro-temperance movement in the United States since the mid to late 19th century,
right,
because of the extreme levels of poverty and drunkenness that were exhibited in a large portion of the very impoverished parts of the industrial revolutionizing United States. And because of that movement, you started to get a political movement developing for, well, we should have an amendment. We should ban the sale of alcohol for, you know, the purposes of imbibing and getting drunk. And that was kind of a pet project that didn't get very far. There was a state or two that tried it out on a ad hoc basis for a few years, but it really didn't start to gain momentum until the late 1890s and into the early 1900s with the Anti-Saloon League, which just happened to be founded by someone from Ohio, of course, the home state of Standard Oil, and by someone who was a lifelong friend of John D. Rockefeller, who
what
personally supported the Anti-Saloon League with millions of dollars.
Right.
And why did John D. Rockefeller support this? Oh, because he was a devout Baptist and a teetotaler himself, and very pious, and he just wanted to improve the state of American society, right? Well, I mean, that's of course the official story, but I think that it's not difficult to see how this directly benefited him when the amendment was passed and prohibition went into effect. And as part of that prohibition, there was a mandate, a federal mandate that went into effect that any fuel alcohol, which was not the type of alcohol that was on sale for imbibing anyway, but it could be theoretically at least used for getting drunk. Well, we can't have that. So you have to add poison, basically, to the fuel alcohols to make sure that they can't be consumed. And what poison are you going to add? Well, petroleum products, actually, were ultimately mandated to be added, ironically enough. And, of course, that put the price point to a point where there's just absolutely no way that the alcohol fuel could have competed with gasoline. And that problem was pretty much taken care of. From that point on, ethanol was only ever even thought of as potentially an additive you could add to gasoline to help prevent engine knock and things of that sort, just basically improve the performance of gasoline-based cars. And from that point on, there was no looking back, and it never really developed. So that was a huge boon for Standard Oil and all of the oil industry, obviously. But I think we can directly see John D. Rockefeller's hand in that.
Well, there's another documentary about, it reminds me of the how Hearst equated marijuana with hemp to outlaw hemp because it directly cut into his profits. So that's another documentary.
Well, and that's directly analogous because, again, it's the idea of having a resource that can be grown by anyone, anywhere, that, you know, will grow readily. And that is the counter solution to these types of industrial production processes that are subscribed to by the monopolists, the people who want to monopolize in order to make the most profit possible. So exactly in the same way that gasoline, obviously, is a petroleum derivative, and oil, the oil industry and the infrastructure was all controlled by Standard Oil at that point. So obviously they were going to try to pump that over fuel alcohol, which, of course, again, could be derived out of pretty much any sort of vegetative biological matter. Apples or whatever could be ground down and made into fuel alcohol. So, yes, it's the exact same thing. And again, hemp, again, almost a wonder product. But of course, if you can demonize one of the sort of derivatives of that, then you can, by association, get the entire thing banned. And we all know how that turned out.
We've already been going for almost a half hour. Can I ask you a couple more questions? Is that
please
okay?
Do. No
okay. Well, so here in the United States, it seems like people judge, and I'm not talking about, you know, me or you, but, you know, people who pay attention to things, but most people, I think, judge how well our foreign policy is going on how much they pay for gas. And so gas is really cheap, comparatively to where it has been here in the United States. And so how does this all relate to Iraq, where, you know, my son died now almost 12 years ago, how really it was created. It was just a country created out of the desert back in, I'm not sure what year. I don't even want to say what year, but can you talk a little bit about that and about how this total takeover of oil affects U.S. foreign policy?
Geopolitics has been structured around the control of oil resources since the early part of the 20th century, when it became quite obvious that this was going to be the power source for militaries of the future and industrial economies of the future. And I think we see that in the development of the events that led toward World War I that I talk about in the documentary, including including the developments that I talked about with the Berlin-Baghdad Railway and the concessions that were granted in Persia, those types of things. I mean, the Middle East map has been dominated and really drawn, as you say, in the boardrooms of Paris 1919. The modern Middle East is really where
that... I was going to say 1920, but I didn't want to say
something. That era, anyway, yes. Yeah. And literally, a lot of these countries were created at that time by basically people in drawing rooms were hammering on the peace treaty there. So we have to understand the map of not only the Middle East, but really a lot of geopolitical relations in relation to that phenomenon. And that's really carried over into the 21st century in quite a few ways, not only the historical remnants of those decisions that were made now almost a century ago, but the still active things that are happening in the region now, obviously with Syria and Iraq. At the forefront at the moment, but also, I mean, in places like Libya, where interestingly enough, yes. I mean, if you look at the some of the earliest protests or uprisings or what have you in the eastern part of Libya that started the narrative towards we have to get rid of Gaddafi now. A lot of those were taking place in areas that were controlled by Chinese oil corporations and trying to develop the Chinese connections to the oil infrastructure in Africa, which were then run out of town, so to speak. And now, of course, we know Libya has devolved into a terrorist cesspool. I mean, it's just not even a functioning country at this point. So a mission accomplished from the perspective of the, you know, would-be overthrowers, I suppose. But I think this goes towards the greater point that the 21st century in many ways is going to be defined by a type of geopolitics that is very much centered on oil pipeline politics. Pipelines are the infrastructure that wires in geopolitical relations. And as those routes are being decided and what, you know, who's going to get the rights here and what concession will be given by this government here, those types of conflicts will in many ways shape the conflicts that we're seeing and already are shaping the conflicts that we're seeing. I mean, one example of that would be the so-called Islamic pipeline that was agreed in principle in 2011 by President Assad in Syria that would have seen the oil being shipped out from Iran up through Iraq, out through Syria, and then shipped through Syria to Europe directly, which would have bypassed a lot of the competing pipeline projects in that area. Well, of course, that's off the table when Syria basically gets blown to pieces and is now a failed country in a lot of ways. So these types of things are still very much ongoing and still very much are dictating where things are going in the future. And I'd also like to stress that it's not necessarily, I think it's not that American corporations are puppeteering the American military to go in and secure these oil resources so that they can get to directly benefit from them in that way. I think to a certain extent, it's about controlling the oil at the wellhead so that you can control how much does or does not get into world markets and just directly control the price, either up or down, as the case may be needed.
So now let's go to a couple more things that you touch on in the documentary. I don't know even know how many cars run on gas in the world. Millions.
At least.
Yeah, tens of millions, hundred, I don't know how many. How many are in the United States? And I want to say in 2006, I sold my car. And I said, I'll never own another car. And that's just a small protest against, you know, these oil companies and the wars for oil and things like that. But so our cars run on it. Our houses, you know, are powered in part by petroleum, oil, whatever. We breathe. The air has these this pollution in it, and we also eat it. And how did big oil worm its way into agriculture?
That is very much tied into the green revolution, quote unquote, which is the.
And I thought that was so interesting. This part of the documentary.
This was a big push starting in the 1950s and into the 1960s to basically modernize the agricultural infrastructure of the developing world. And this, of course, was presented as just benevolence on the part of, you know, the ruling American Empire, spreading out its largesse around the world to help the poor and needy masses. And let's not be overly black and white about this. There are benefits that have accrued to people who have directly, I mean, been able to access food supplies that perhaps they otherwise might not have been, might not have appeared in such abundance in certain places in the world. Although even those direct benefits of the so-called Green Revolution have been oversold. I include a link to a scientific article about India, actually, in the documentary, if people are interested, showing that, in fact, the rate of increase in agricultural production in India declined after the Green Revolution. It was still a positive rate of increase, but it was actually declining at that point, which is interesting. But regardless of that, I think the underlying point is, as with so many of the other things that I talk about in the documentary, this largesse, this giving, this magnanimous granting of resources and money to various projects often comes for a particular purpose, for a stratagem. And in this case, part of it was the spreading of technologies that relied on, in every step of the process, petroleum derivatives, whether that's petroleum fertilizers to machinery, farm machinery that ran on petroleum products that directly benefited the DuPonts and BASF and these other oligarch connected industrial concerns.
Right.
But also, of course, it created an infrastructure which benefited these types of monopolistic organizations in even secondary and tertiary ways. When you look, for example, at the ways that rural farmers were displaced from their traditional existence by the creation of these mechanized farm, agricultural products or agricultural processes that took all of these rural farmers, made them, out of work and forced them off the land that they were working into the city slums, right, where they became ready workers for large international manufacturing concerns. And we see that in Southeast Asia and in South America and other places where this process played out. So it was win-win-win for these corporations that got to spread all this technology around that directly benefited them at the expense, let it be said, of mostly the American taxpayer through U.S. The Food for Peace program that Eisenhower instituted and other programs like that, that ultimately was spending a lot of U.S. taxpayer money on these corporations so that they could then engage in this largesse. And unfortunately, that was only catapulted and springboarded by the gene revolution that we're currently living through, the attempt to basically do the exact same thing, but spreading this biotechnology, quote-unquote, i.e. genetically modified monstrosities, right, around, right, the world. Right. Again, at the back largely of World Bank, IMF, USAID, those types of organizations that are sending this to places that are least able to say no to them, even though actually some of them are still saying no to that type of aid.
Yeah, it's getting increasingly more difficult for them to do that. Oh, Monsanto, you are so restrained in this documentary. I'm thinking Standard Oil, evil. BP, evil. Shell, evil. Monsanto, evil. It's just like, they just created all kinds of disease and destruction. And oh my God, it's just
the facts speak for themselves, right? I mean, the editorializing, I think people who see this documentary and understand and can look through the sources will piece that together for themselves.
Amazing. You did an amazing job on this documentary, James. This last thing I want to talk about, because it's very close to me, is how chemotherapy got developed from this, the takeover, the total complete domination of big oil.
Yes, most people have no idea about this this process, and I didn't until I started really researching into it. But of course, what we now understand as chemotherapy was largely developed by a researcher named Cornelius Rhodes, who was in fact, he was a Rockefeller Institute pathologist, of right, course, Rockefeller Institute, because again, a lot of these same families, including the oligarchs, have funded all sorts of medical research over the years and become the medical industry as we know it today. And Cornelius Rhodes, no exception. But before he was a Rockefeller Institute pathologist, he was actually in the U.S. Army, heading up the Chemical Warfare Service, where he was researching such things as mustard gas, trying to develop better bio-warfare techniques and, right, and concoctions. And it was from that research, the mustard gas research, that chemotherapy was developed. And it's a fascinating part of history. Again, I hope people will go and read through the sources to read through that history. It's not denied. It's openly acknowledged that it was mustard gas, and it was basically the chemical warfare service of the U.S. Army that Rhodes took, and he took most of his team and just brought them over to the Rockefeller Institute, where they started making working on cancer. And how do you cure cancer? Well, by killing it. And how do you kill it? Well, you take these biowarfare techniques and, hey, let's use them for this purpose. So that's really where it comes from.
Let's not just kill the cancer. Let's kill the good things, the person. I think chemotherapy might be effective in some cases, but, I recently read a study where 84% of oncologists say if they got cancer, they would not take chemo, but they prescribe it to their patients.
Yeah. Yes, and they and to a certain extent they have to because of the licensing that exists right now, which is dominated by the American Medical Association, which has its roots in the late 19th century and is intimately tied in with the Rockefeller and Carnegie and other foundations that helped to fund, for example, the Flexner Report, which I talk about in the documentary, that standardized American medical education and that standardized the big pharma style of medicine that we understand today. They made that out of the sort of hodgepodge of traditional and folk and remedies and things that, that existed in late 19th century America. They decided to standardize that, and of course they standardized it under a system which, again, they could directly profit from on every turn, as a lot of the chemical corporations that are behind the pharmaceutical manufacturers are, again, tied into petrochemical derivatives, which they now sell as the cures for the a lot of the diseases that they themselves
causing. That yeah, they exactly. cause. And Sloan, was it your documentary that talked about Sloan Kettering?
Yes. Yeah. And well, how, Cornelius Rhodes was working as director of research at... Mm-hmm.
And they got so much money. The Rockefeller Foundation gave them like tons of money or people connected with it. I call it the cancer industrial complex. I think it's very intimately connected to everything we've been talking about.
Absolutely. Again, all of the connections are there. And if people want to go and look at these people, there's people like Frank Howard, who was a Standard Oil of New Jersey executive. And he was the one who persuaded Sloan and Kettering, Alfred Sloan and Charles Kettering, to donate their fortunes to a cancer center.
Oh,
that
okay.
was the foundation
That's the
of
connection.
Sloan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, they hire Cornelius Rhodes from the Rockefeller Institute Pathology Lab, and he creates chemotherapy out of mustard gas.
So you're working on part two of this documentary?
I am, and if you can believe it, it's an even bigger picture that I'm attempting to paint. So, and I want to try to keep it as information packed and as short as is reasonably possible. But there's
concise.
So much.
Concise, we'll say concise. Yeah. But
concise.
You do just a great job. So, James, thank you so much for your time and taking so much time on the soapbox today. And just tell people how they can get more information, or if there's anything else you'd like to add.
Well, I think, again, the documentary speaks for itself. You can find it easily enough online. Just type mm-hmm. How Big Oil Conquered the World into any search engine. I'm sure it'll come up. But you can find myself and my work at CorbettReport.com. That's CorbettReport.com. And that's a one-stop shop for all of my videos and articles, interviews, podcasts, everything. There are thousands and thousands of hours of media available for free download. I hope people will use it as the resource that it's intended to be.
Well, say hi to our friends in Japan, and they're fighting the fight for demilitarization and you know, ending the use of nuclear power. And, you know, the Japanese are really there in the trenches, that's for sure.
They sure are. I'll give them your konnichiwa.
Okay. James Corbett, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. This was a fascinating conversation.
Thank you for having me. Anytime.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's the Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and excited to watch the video and check out more information from James Corbett. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank James Corbett for being my wonderful guest this week. And I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to the Soapbox. Peace out for now.